Broadcasting from Youngstown, Ohio, this is the MV Red Podcast, the show where we talk about news and politics impacting the Mahoning Valley, the state of Ohio, and the USA. If you want to subscribe to our podcast, find us on your favorite podcast streaming app or visit our website, www.mvred.com. If you want to share your opinion with us, please email info@mvred.com, as we would love to hear from you. Now, let's get things started. Here are your hosts, Michael Metzinger and Dane Davis.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 11th episode of the MV Red Podcast. My name is Michael Metzinger, and joining me once again is my co-host, Dane Davis. For another Facebook Live episode, and we're real excited about this. So want to start off checking in with Dane. How's the self-distancing quarantine working out for you?
It's going well. Is it streaming? Is it working? I think it's working. Are you sharing it to your own personal Facebook page, Michael?
I'm about to share it.
I'm going to share it to mine. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. All right. Share on a page you manage.
I'm gonna do a watch party on the Michael Metzinger Facebook page.
Yeah, you should do that. Can I share that? Yeah, I'm super into that. Let me go to wow. I want to share this. Share now. Okay, it got shared to my timeline. We're live. Oh. We're rocking and rolling.
Awesome. So, on today's episode, we're going to continue talking about the coronavirus, and we're getting to a stage where we have some states that are already opening up, and for us here in Ohio, Governor DeWine is planning on announcing on Monday his plans for, or the steps to open up the state, and he plans to open up the state, at least in some way, starting on May 1st. So we're going to talk about that. I also want to discuss the antibody tests that have come up. There's been four major ones, or four that have at least come up that have been publicized in from Boston, New York City, Los Angeles, and Santa Clara, California. So we're going to talk about those four antibody tests and what that means, just to provide some context for the overall impact of this virus and if it's as lethal as we initially thought. Dane wants to talk about the models, and I know much was made about these models because the models in many ways triggered a lot of the stay-at-home orders across the United States and all the precautions that we took. So we're going to discuss those items. I want to vent a little bit about Tim Ryan's stimulus plan that he has, $2,000 a month until we return to pre-COVID-19 levels. So we're going to get into that, and Dane wants to talk about Joe Biden as well, and at least some allegations about him, and maybe we'll even chime in as to, you know, it's April 24th now, and our thoughts as where we're currently at with our odds of who we think might have the early edge in terms of the 2020 general election. So let's get started. And we are broadcasting live on Facebook Live. So first and foremost, we encourage everybody, if you have any questions throughout the evening, by all means, send them to us. You could do it in the chat here on Facebook, and we'll definitely make this interactive. We certainly encourage as much feedback as possible. And if you guys have any questions or anything like that or disagree with us, by all means, let us know. I think it's really important to listen to the other side. So if you're somebody who completely disagrees with us, by all means, let us know, and we'll be happy to discuss your critiques and criticisms. So, Dane, why don't you start it off? Let's talk about opening the economy up on May 1st and your overall thoughts on that.
Well, first of all, can people hear me? Your brother, Tommy Metzinger, the chief of the Metzinger clan, said he couldn't hear me. Can people hear my voice? If there's anybody in the chat, can you hear me? Hello?
I guess one thing would be, do you have your mic muted on your computer?
I don't think so. I think I'm good on my computer, but here, I don't know. People are saying...
I apologize, everybody. I think that one was on me.
Did you have me muted?
No, apparently I had to click a button for you. And so just full disclosure, we're using a different piece of software this episode to stream. So I want to apologize for everybody in the chat that may not have been seeing Dane as I was talking to him because I'm recording on a different setup here. So Dane, I believe, is now visible. Let's see if people can hear him now. There we go. All right. I got a confirmation that we're good now. So I apologize, okay, everybody.
Can you hear me? Am I being censored? The voice of truth is being censored by Michael Metzinger. I hope people can hear me. I really want Tommy Metzinger to hear me. He's the big chief of the Metzinger tribe, right? He's the head big Chungus brother. So I hope people can hear me. Tommy said can't hear him. Got him. Okay. People can hear.
Thank you, everybody.
Okay, that's good. Thank you. Sorry for the technical difficulties.
Yeah, I apologize.
Here, you know,
we'll figure this out eventually, people.
You're an accountant, right? Clearly not an IT guy.
Correct.
But you're free, so I guess that it still counts. Yeah. So I don't know. What's the question? What do you want to talk about, Michael? So, the economy?
Well,
coronavirus?
Yes.
So, people dying? People not
dying? Let's talk about the economy.
Let's talk about the economy, yeah.
So a lot – if you read social media, I'm part of a group that's like the Dr. Amy Acton fan club. And there's the other different posts that I've seen on Facebook where there is a group of people who are very adamant in any way, shape, or form of us opening up effective May 1st. They think the health risk far outweigh the potential economic risks that we're facing, and they don't believe that we should go back to work or people shouldn't be able to go back to work starting May 1st. I think that's kind of a dangerous precedent that you're setting there. And because at some point or another, people have to get back to work. We're, 24 million people over the last month have gone on unemployment, staggering numbers. So let's start talking about that.
So, you know, let me start by answering that question indirectly. I was reading an article that said that the price of pork bellies has gone to zero. Or not zero, but has fallen off. And the price of bacon and like processed pork has skyrocketed. And the reason why, right? So you take a pork belly, you put it in a pork factory, right? For lack of a better word, it gets processed into processed pork products, bacon, sausage, ham, whatever we eat in the stores. But there's been a huge divergence in those prices. And the worry was in this news story that people are going to have to start slaughtering pork, the actual live pigs. They're going to have to start slaughtering them en masse. And the reason why was, I think it was Tyson Foods shut down because of coronavirus, a pork processing plant. Now, this is just one story, but there are stories like this. I read a story about potatoes. They can't find enough potatoes to be processed, and so they're going to start burning potatoes. I think there were citrus trees or some sort of citrus fruit, right, was getting burned because they can't process it. Fish, surprisingly, people don't want to get takeout fish, right, because it doesn't taste as good fresh. So the point I'm bringing up is there are little creeks starting to appear in the supply chain. And the way the economy works is it's like everything that's very small makes major effects once it gets amplified, right? Take a rock, throw it in a pond, and the ripples are the effects of a single action. I am becoming increasingly concerned that the economic damage that we're talking about might be so severe that there's no clear way that you can just restart, right? There's this mistaken belief out there that the economy is like a switch. We can flip it on. Uh-oh, we've got a virus. It's come over from China because somebody in China ate a bat. Flip off the economy. Okay, 6 weeks later, flip it back on, right? And I'm really becoming concerned that we're going to have severe economic consequences that we don't even know of, that I can't even talk to you about, right? I think that there was a really rude thing that people were saying, and people have been rude throughout this, but they're like, the people that are concerned about the economy only care about their 401ks. Listen, I'm 31 years old, okay? I'm not going to retire for another 35 years. I don't care about my 401k. If it goes up, if it goes down, makes no difference to me because I'm not going to be able to use it for another 35 years. I don't care about the stock market for the same reason, right? But I am very, very concerned about people on unemployment and in particular the supply chains, getting basic goods and supplies to our households. we've run down a lot of inventories, and I'm not sure we're still producing at the same levels that we were. And there are some severe side effects to that. So my point to you, and this goes to your question, I'm not trying to answer indirectly, but I think we've done very severe damage to the economy. I think it's not going to be easy to restart. I think we need to restart as soon as we can. And it's not because I want to make more money, or I want my stock portfolio to go up, or I want to get a haircut at a salon, or any of those other reasons that you see kind of trivialized on Facebook. I want to see the economy restart because I'm very severe, or I'm very scared that we will see severe consequences of this. And look, let's be absolutely real about this. Somebody like me, I should be okay, right? Somebody like you should be okay. You're a white-collar worker. I'm a white-collar worker, right? But I'm afraid that if you have a massive wave of layoffs where you have 24 million people unemployed, it goes up to 30 to 40 million people, that you can't restart it because there's such a collapse in aggregate demand. So I think we have to restart the economy. We'll get into the actual consequences of the virus later, but I think DeWine has handled it well, and that we need to start having a phased restart. Some states where it hasn't been that big of a problem can start now. But I think the sooner we can get this economy back up and running, the better, because I am very scared of the consequences of what's going to happen.
I agree. And I obviously, as somebody who leans more to the right, follow a lot of people on social media that are like-minded as me. And I've noticed a lot of criticism of, of Governor DeWine.
Thank you.
And Amy Acton. And in some ways, you know, I could see it to an extent, but I think it's important to give credit where credit's due, that we're in a situation where on April 24th, we could actually have a path to open up this state effective on May 1st, which I think is very important. You can't have a country if people are continuously forced to stay at home and collect unemployment. I think people ultimately do want to go
right
back to work. I mean, who just wants to sit at home, collect unemployment with this uncertainty that you might not have a job? And I think I'm of the perspective that the longer this goes on, the greater uncertainty that a lot of these jobs that we thought might be a temporary layoff might become permanent layoffs. In the last episode, we talked about things like retail. I'm somebody who does watch retail. I wrote a blog last year on the Southern Park Mall and the future of that. And it's in a sector of the economy I've paid pretty close attention to. And leading up to this, like a JCPenney was struggling immensely, and Macy's was about to shed another 125 stores. And we're talking about an entire month. It's probably going to be about 5 or 6 weeks in total where they're going to be virtually shut down other than online sales. How could those types of businesses survive? And those are just two retailers. Just think of all of the other different types of businesses that, like restaurants, for instance. I mean, you might be able to get by for a month, maybe 2 months on takeout orders. But if, you know, let's say we open them back up, there's going to be all these new regulations in place. You're probably not going to have as many people that you're allowed in at any point in time. Bars are going to be probably one of the absolute last things that are going to open up. So we need to find a way to open this up. And I think DeWine knows that. And I'm sure I'm just speculating here, that Acton would probably be resistant to opening up just from the health perspective. But I think DeWine realized this, and you got to weigh the pros and cons of everything, and you got to have that element of trust. And we've trusted the Ohioans, the people of this state, over the last 5 weeks, and that for the most part, they've done a great job. And we have to trust them now, starting May 1st, that we could open up the state, we could do so responsibly, and we will not let this virus kick back in and go back on another upward slope.
Yeah. So there's a couple of things to keep in mind, right, when it comes to the virus, right? Let's go back to numbers. Imagine a spectrum of understanding the virus. There's one end that says this is the end of the world, right? This virus is going to kill you, your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, your child, and your cat, right? Everything's going to be dead. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is like, hey, this is less deadly than the cold, okay? When the virus was first into the when it was first released in China. This is crucial. We did not know what type of virus it was. It was a complete unknown because the Chinese, we saw social media posts, we saw videos and stuff that came out, but the Chinese were mum about what was going on. And not only were they mum about what was going on, they lied. And they lied to the WHO, which is acting as their mouthpiece. There's a famous tweet on January 11th where they said there's no human-to-human transmission, right? Everybody was saying, you know, it's not a big deal, it's not a big deal, it's not a big deal. We didn't know where on the spectrum this virus was, right? I'm trying to balance it on the camera. And so governors acted, and they acted quickly by quarantining and shutting everything down. And I get that. I understand that. And I defend that because when you don't know what's going on, an abundance of caution states that you have to shut down. And when they shut down, what was the key justification? It was a quantifiable justification. It was our hospital system capacity, specifically ICUs and ventilators, right? Here's the capacity level. If the virus is as severe as we think, we're going to see a huge increase in cases. It's going to overwhelm our ICUs, and people that suffer from, say, cancer or a gunshot or a car accident, there's not going to be any room for them, and they're going to die, right? And we're going to have mass death. And we heard 2 to 3 million deaths, okay? We've learned a lot more about the virus since then. The virus is severe. It's worse than a regular flu, but it's not that much worse, okay? It's not a 3% mortality rate. It's like a 0.4% mortality rate from our studies. It's more widespread than we thought, right? It's important to note when we see that cases are rising, it's not necessarily because there are more cases per se. It's also because our testing capacity is rising. We're testing more people. There have been a bunch of studies that have come out. One on New York City, I think mothers in the delivery room. Another, the famous Stanford study. Another one just recently released of New York State, et cetera, where they show that like between 15 and 20% of the people are infected. So there's been a much greater infection rate. There was one in Germany that showed a higher infection rate, one in Bergamo, Italy that showed a higher infection rate. Why are these studies important? Because they show that the death rate is not the 3% that we're seeing, right? Of here's who we've tested, here's who died, right? The death rate is actually far lower because, yeah, we've tested this amount, but there are a lot more people who we've not tested and have the virus. And moreover, they're asymptomatic, okay? So as this information has become available, all of that curve, let's flatten the curve, that has changed. The dynamics changed. We've never come close to overwhelming our hospital system, okay, in all the various states. Our hospital system capacity is fine. They're sending ships home in New York, that big boat. The Navy boat, I think the USS Mercy, they're staying at home because there are not enough cases, right? They built this big hospital in Central Park, not enough cases. They did one in Seattle for the stadium, not enough cases, right? So the point is that this is a deadly virus. It's worse than the flu, but it's not as bad as we initially thought. Given that the hospital system is nowhere close to being overwhelmed, right? All of a sudden, the costs on the ledger starts to shift, right? And if we have 40 to 50,000 people have died in the United States currently, let's add another 20 to 30,000 to get us through the spring. We have to weigh that versus severe supply chain shortages, rise in suicides, alcoholism, drug abuse, from unemployment, from economic deprivation. There have been a lot of hospital routine visits being rescheduled or canceled for cancer care. For various surgeries have been delayed. That's all going to eat into lifespan, right? So there are costs on both sides. And to me, I think the costs now show firmly in the corner of it's not as bad as we thought. There was no sin in shutting down initially, but let's start to reopen gradually and get the country back to work. If you're under the age of 60 or 55, this virus is not that deadly, okay? More than half of the deaths have been people over the age of like 80 or 75 in nursing homes. We need to quarantine the nursing homes and shut down and control access. But like the idea that it's going to kill you and me and, you know, our wives, it's not true. But you have people so freaked out about it.
Yeah, so that's a good segue into these antibody tests, which you alluded to a little bit in what you just stated. So there's one in Chelsea, Massachusetts, I believe. It was just outside of Boston. It's like a suburb of Boston where they took a random sample of 200 people and ended up having 30% of them had symptoms or had the virus, and many of which were asymptomatic. The latest one that Governor Cuomo of New York announced, I think it was yesterday or 2 days ago, was one that in the New York Times, it says that 1 in 5 in this random sample of New York City residents would have had the virus. So that's a, you know, a city of what, 10 million plus people. So that would be 2 million people in that city, the largest city in the country, having the virus. And then out in California, we have Santa Clara County, which is just south of San Francisco, and in Los Angeles County, obviously out there in California as well. So in this article from the New York Times, where it says coronavirus antibodies in California, it says there's a quote where it reads, "If the numbers prove accurate, the coronavirus may be less deadly than originally expected, with a fatality rate more closely resembling that of the seasonal flu strain than a pandemic of profound lethality." So I think that's extremely important. Now, again, you alluded to it with the Chinese and the World Health Organization. The lack of transparency there was critical to what we're facing right now in this country. But, you know, we talked about it on the last episode with China and their supposed however many number of cases, only 80,000 cases in a country with over a billion people, when we're at what, 500,000 plus cases or whatever we're at here in the U.S., a country of 300 million people. I really think that lack of transparency has hurt us, and we're unfortunately going to have to learn the hard way. And we're having to do these types of studies because we can't trust anything that the Chinese or the World Health Organization is letting us know of. So now that we're getting this information out there, I think this is immensely important to the push by governors across the country and Trump with the hopes of opening up. Because using that quote right there where it says this would have a fatality rate much more in line with the seasonal flu. Well, obviously, in our lifetime, probably ever in our country's history, we've never done this for a seasonal flu. And now that we have this bit of information, I think it's really important to put that in context of everything going on out there. I understand that there's a great deal of concern by people because, especially in Mahoning County, it's one of the highest death rates, I believe, still in the state of Ohio, although we're the 12th largest county. And just from seeing on reading the obituaries every day and seeing other reports, there's different people that I've seen who have unfortunately passed away from this. And it's tough when it hits close to home with people. But I do think we need to take a step back and put all of this in context of how this is comparing right now in comparison to the seasonal flu.
You know, a couple of points to make, and we're getting some questions in the chat. What about the psychological impact? Many are scared away from participating in the economy because of media coverage. I think that's absolutely true. I think there are a lot of people that are very scared who are not at risk from this virus. The vast majority of cases, or at least 50%, right? I mean, we're still getting more information. Are asymptomatic. You could have the virus, you move on with your life, you have no idea, right? If you're a 20-something or 30-something, unless you have a very severe pre-existing condition, it's highly unlikely that you're going to die from this, right? But somebody goes on Facebook and they read that one Facebook post that somebody wrote about how severe the virus is, and they get freaked out because they're not looking at data. They're not looking at bell curves or statistics or anything like that. It's the anecdotes that really scare people and really stick with people. That said, you know, in my opinion, the economy is not going to come back right away. It's still going to be delayed. But we need to allow people, 10% of my normalized revenue or 20% of my normalized revenue is far better than zero, right? 33% of my normalized revenue is better than zero. So having opening up the economy to a certain degree and allowing supply chains to function normally, in my opinion, is far better than the current freezing. Somebody else asks, how are large pockets of the population asymptomatic carriers if the virus is novel? Well, I don't think the newness of the virus, the fact that it's asymptomatic for a large portion of people is a inherent characteristic of the virus. And I don't have a medical degree, so I don't want to get too deep into this. But, you know, people react differently depending upon the virus. The fact that it's new doesn't mean that it precludes it being asymptomatic. But let me make another point. unfortunately, the reaction to this virus has fallen along partisan lines, right? So much of America falls along partisan lines. And it seems like the Republicans are like, open the economy. And Republican governors in the South and in the West are keener on opening. The blue state governors and blue state populations are like, no, don't open ever, right? And I think it's really unfortunate that this has been, the reaction has been polarized, right? Because it's become a Rorschach test of politics. I know I mispronounced that, but I think that there are some people, you know, on the opening economy folks are saying, you know, everybody wants to just sit and collect a paycheck, right? When a lot of those people are genuinely afraid. Vice versa, they're the other side saying, well, you know, people just want their 401k to go up. They don't care if grandma dies, right? Where those other people that want the economy to open up are genuinely afraid of the continued economic effects. So it's kind of sad that this has been polarized when, you know, a clear look at the data should show that it's not as bad as we thought. We can open up, you know, given that it's not nearly what we thought it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is unfortunate. Something like this really should become a partisan issue in any way, shape, or form.
But it is. It is.
I think you could. It shouldn't. But I mean, I think it was nice to see a few weeks ago when there was, although there was criticism from time to time going back and forth between Trump and Cuomo and maybe Trump and Gavin Newsom in California, but there was also some praise from back from time to time and an acknowledgement that things have been working out. And that's how it should be. And it's unfortunate. I think so much of it is this age of social media where people can just follow everybody they agree with, completely tune out everybody they disagree with, and they get into this bubble of political thought where, God forbid, there's an opposing analysis or what. We ourselves have praised Trump at times on this, criticized Trump, and we've done the same. Those are both Republican politicians that, you know, because we're to the right, doesn't mean we think everything they've done has been perfect on this. And quite frankly, I don't see how any politician of any party could be perfect on this response because of the information that we're discovering on a day-by-day basis. You know, I understand a polarizing time, but people need to take a step back. This should not be a partisan thing. You know, give praise when somebody needs to have praise. As simple as that. Just leave the politics out of it.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you, Tim Smith,
for the nice compliment there.
Oh, he complimented you on your beard.
Yeah, not really much of one, though.
No, not really at all. Sorry. It's interesting how this is again falling upon partisan lines, but here's the other thing that I find very disturbing, right? Is that people seem so willing to trade away their basic liberties, and we're talking the most basic liberties, to the government. And I'm just a little disturbed by that. Like, I get it, it's a pandemic, etc., but there almost seems to be a portion of the population that likes the infantilization that has resulted from the quarantines, right? Where you basically just stay in home, you surf the internet, you watch Netflix, you play video games, you order delivery food. And if you're a white collar worker, you're getting a paycheck, right? And there's a portion of the population that's like, hey, this is great. Why does this ever need to end? I find that a little scary. I think people have become a little too comfortable with the quarantine. And it's almost like they've settled into it. They like the setup and they're attacking anybody that wants to end it because they think it's a pretty comfy setup. Now, again, I'm not saying that's the majority of the people that are worried about lifting the quarantine too early, but I do think that that population does exist. And don't forget, unemployment benefits, they've added $600 to the standard unemployment benefit. So some people are making more money now on unemployment than they were working.
Yeah.
So
I didn't read the full article, but I saw something posted. It was related to one of those paycheck protection loans where SBA through a local or regional or national bank loans money to a small business under 500 employees if they maintain their full-time number of employees and use those funds for payroll over an eight-week period, it gets forgiven. So it's essentially a grant. And the gist of the summary of what I read of the article was one of a small business, not sure what state, got one of those grants. And the employer was having a tough time bringing the employees back because the argument was they were actually making more on unemployment than they would if they were to go back to work and work for this person. And now that person's stuck with, am I able to find anybody else when people are making more money on unemployment? And if you can't, then you're going to be stuck with a loan that you're going to have to pay off in 2 years. So it's unfortunate. It's one of those items in the CARES Act or the Family First Act. I'm not sure which one included the unemployment provisions. But it's something I think probably some would like to rewrite, but it may have been a compromise to get the thing passed in the first place.
So here's the final point I want to bring up about the quarantines and stuff is that there's been this shift in the debate. Okay. There's been a massive shift in the debate. And this is something I brought up last time, and I think it still holds true. The initial justification for the quarantine, which was a valid and legitimate justification, was the threat to the hospital system, that it would become overwhelmed. 2 to 3 million deaths, right? Those numbers, those models were wrong. It wasn't just outside the margin of error, right? Anytime a model predicts any sort of trend line, there's always a range attached to it. It wasn't just that. You're off by a magnitude, a really significant magnitude, okay? The hospitalization system throughout the country, by and large, is stable, and it's not at risk of being overrun. So then it was shifted. We need more ventilators. We need more ventilators, right? We have more than enough ventilators now. Actually, the United States is exporting ventilators to, I think, Ecuador or Peru or some South American country because we have so many. And here's the proof in the pudding. California and the state of Washington, where they had pretty severe and early outbreaks, are sending away their ventilators to other parts of the country, okay? If you really thought that this was going to be a big problem, you would not send away a single ventilator. So now the grounds have shifted that, well, we can't open up until we have testing. Right? We need testing, you know, hey, you moron, we need testing, right? So all of a sudden, something that was a very proximate and real and quantifiable threat has been shifted to testing. Well, how much testing do we need? Do we need to test everybody? Do we need to test continually? You know, like, you could test me today, I don't have the virus. I go to the Metzinger house, I lick your doorknob, and then tomorrow I have the virus, right?
Don't do that.
No, I would never dare, right? But that could happen, right? So what's the deal? We need more tests. We need more tests. We need more tests. And in actuality, if you read the news stories, Quest Diagnostics, which is a national testing center, has said that they have surplus capacity, right? We've already reached max capacity in testing in certain locales, not across the entire country. But the testing question raises the other question. Why do we need testing? Well, we need testing to isolate people so it doesn't spread. Okay, I'm kind of with you. But let's remember, we're not trying to stop this virus from spreading. We can't. The cat's out of the bag, right? Our goal, we know the virus is going to spread. Our goal is to prevent the hospitalization system from becoming overloaded, okay? But you don't hear about that anymore because the models were wrong and the goalposts have shifted. So there's been a continual shifting of the goalposts. And here's why it's critical, because millions of people are suffering, right? I know there was a lot of mocking on Facebook of the people protesting, right? They're like, oh, these guys are morons, right? These guys are stupid, and they had misspelled signs and stuff like that. Well, you know, I'm sure there were some morons out there, don't get me wrong. And if you go to these things, you should probably be wearing protection, like masks and stuff. But these are people that are, you know, call it the lower middle class, that they own small businesses or they work in small businesses and they're suffering. Not everybody is lucky enough to have a white collar yuppie job where you're continuing getting your paycheck while you click on Outlook, right? So it looks like you're busy. So what's the point of all this? The point of all this is that the grounds for the justification for the shutdowns have shifted. And it's really, really important that when this is all said and done, if we enter in a Great Depression, where we have 30 million people unemployed, GDP collapsed by 30%, big companies going out of business, we need to be able to say, okay, we were wrong, and here's who was wrong, right? The Imperial University model that freaked everybody out, that model was wrong. That guy, if you read his past predictions, he's been wrong continually, right? This whole idea, well, we should just shut up and listen to experts. Well, guess what? Experts can be wrong. Economists, you know, there's something called herd thinking, right? Where nobody wants to be the guy that raises his hand in a crowd of 100 people and say, I'm the one that disagrees, right? Smart people can do very dumb things when they're in a group. It's really important to keep in mind. So the point of all this is to say the grounds have shifted. I think we need to open up. We do need to protect the people in nursing homes and the elderly population. They're clearly most at risk. This is something more severe as a flu, but it's not what it was originally sold as. And, you know, we're entering in a Great Depression, and everybody that was a really smarmy little jerk on Facebook that was like, hey, you know, this is the worst thing to happen. You guys were wrong. Okay. It's okay to be wrong. Admit it, but let's work together and get the economy moving. There you go. There's my rant for the day, or at least for now.
Yeah. I agree with everything you said. And I think it would go a long way if some of these government officials would just say, hey, the information we had when we first presented this to you, the taxpayers, to you, the citizens of the U.S. or citizens of XX, whatever state, some of that information, some of those models were just way off.
They were wrong.
And yeah, they were wrong. And, you know, we only had so much information that was available to us at a time. And obviously, I'm an accountant. I screw things up from time to time. We all do in our various professions. I think the acknowledgement of it would go a long way. You mentioned a few other things like that herd thinking mentality. The only thing, this is just a random thought, probably doesn't really mean much of anything, but it sort of would be like the equivalent of somebody back in the 2016 election saying, Donald Trump, I'm 100% sure is going to win. When the consensus among the political punditry, that class of people, all the polls were showing polar opposite, virtually zero chance that he was going to win, something like that. You talked about the models and the impact on our hospital system. So in New York, they set up a hospital or interim, a temporary one, I believe, at the Javits Center, where Hillary Clinton's election night was held. Got very little usage. There was one, I believe, in Washington State. Another one that the Fed set up.
It was in a stadium.
Was that one in the stadium?
Yeah.
Okay. And another one, very little usage. And then here locally in Mahoning County, they were going to set one up at the Covelli Center, the downtown arena here in Youngstown. And it put a quick stop to that as well.
Yeah, it's done.
So just some overall thoughts. There is an article that I did tweet. And actually, before I get to that, or not tweet, I did post in the chat. There were a couple comments I wanted to chime in on. Don Rudolph commented on how there was that Democrat state rep from Michigan who had COVID-19, who had met with Trump after she had recovered. And she was one of those people who ended up using that hydroxychloroquine. If I'm saying that right or wrong, I apologize. I'm certainly no medical expert. I know of somebody close to me who not a big fan of that drug. But I will say this, somebody I know who's also a doctor had tweeted or sent or I posted on Facebook about how, and if I'm off on this organization, if this is not a legitimate organization, I'm pretty sure it is, the Infectious Diseases Society of America, one of their recommendations for COVID patients is actually that combination that Trump has touted with that that hydroxychloroquine and I forget what the other one was. I'm not even going to be in to pronounce it. I'm not sure if it's a Z-Pack, but nonetheless, I just wanted to comment on that since Don Rudolph chimed in on that. I also posted an article from The Hill. It was from a doctor from Stanford. He's the former chief of their neuroradiology at Stanford University, and he makes an opinion piece, the case for opening up the economy. And there's a couple points I wanted to highlight from that article that I posted here in the chat. The first was a recent Stanford University antibody study that we mentioned a few minutes ago, now estimates that the fatality rate if infected is likely 0.1% to 0.2%, a risk far lower than the previous World Health Organization estimates that were 20 to 30 times higher and that motivated isolation policies. Case in point right there. We were relying on the WHO. Their information that was provided to us and to other countries has been entirely wrong. these antibody tests. Again, we've had four of them thus far, but they have been in some hot spots in the country, have shown that this is a lot less lethal. Another interesting quote from his study was of 6,570 confirmed COVID-19 deaths fully investigated for underlying conditions to date, 99.2% of them had an underlying illness, which is remarkable. And then another thing he said here is, which I think this is going to be a point that we're going to uncover over the months ahead, is how critical health care for millions of Americans is being ignored. And what he's talking about here is how most states and many hospitals abruptly stop non-essential medical procedures and surgery. But the point he's trying to make here is those procedures oftentimes are the precursor to finding different things like cancer and other major diseases. And by preventing those types of medical procedures from happening, there are people now at risk down the road of maybe not catching cancer or some other disease that they can't treat and could ultimately become fatal. So I posted that in the chat. I think it was a good piece by this doctor from Stanford. He I think presents 5 or 6 points as to why we should open up the economy starting on May 1st. And I encourage people, wherever you're at on this, read the piece, because he presents it based on some logical facts, not from the emotions. There's this issue that I always have with people when they let emotions get in the way of facts. Don't let the emotions get in the way of the facts that this individual is presenting, because I think if you just open your eyes to what his argument is, it would go a long way to maybe making you realize, okay, it's very risky it's much more risky for probably that age 60 plus category, and especially age 60 plus that have underlying conditions. But for the rest of us, the odds of we might get it, but the odds of it being something that where we're required to go to a hospital or, God forbid, go into an intensive care unit is very, very little. So just a few thoughts that I wanted to share. But I definitely encourage everybody to read that Hill article.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Any other thoughts on the coronavirus? I apologize, everybody. I'm reading.
You're reading the super chats.
I'm reading. My wife is she's saying negative, so I'm not sure.
Now, negative.
Full disclosure: my wife and I are on the opposite ends of the spectrum in terms of how to handle this. And I said on the last episode, she's very freaked out by this.
Oh,
and
well, so, this leads perfectly into the next point I was going to make about school marmocracy. America has become a school marmocracy, right? So, have you heard about the meme on Twitter and that called Karens? Okay, so there's this new meme out there where, and I'm not saying I endorse it, I'm just going to describe it, where there are Karens, right? And a Karen is a middle-class woman with that one blonde haircut that goes like, it's like a bowl cut, right? And she's the type of woman that asks to speak to your manager, right? If she's not happy, or she leaves like a $1 tip, or like basically your uptight suburban soccer mom is a Karen. Right. I'm trying to think of another example of what would be a very big Karenism. Right. And I think throughout this entire coronavirus thing, right, America has become a school momocracy or Karenocracy. Right. A school mom is like somebody who's very prudish, kind of uptight, you know, is a tattletale. I'm trying to think of a good way to describe a school mom, right? It's a Karen. It's like another version of a Karen, right? And I notice,
God, poor Karen here.
She is. I feel bad. I know several Karens, and they're all really nice people. But America has kind of fallen to the lowest common denominator, where if somebody doesn't feel safe, right, or if somebody feels at risk, all of a sudden everything has to shut down to serve them. And I'm going to make this point. This is very controversial and I probably should not say this, but you know, the baby boomers were very comfortable sending Generation X and the millennial generation to fight in Afghanistan, to fight in Iraq, to fight in, I'm trying to think of any other recent wars, right? They're keen on any sort of conflict, right? So when it comes to millennial lives or Generation X lives, the baby boomers are like, yeah, go fine. You know, hey, millennial, Not everybody lives forever, right? But now that we have something that threatens them, all the boomers are like, whoa, 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 shut down the economy, right? And this is, I feel like coronavirus is only going to heighten the generational conflict between millennials and baby boomers, because this virus, by and large, there are exceptions, don't get me wrong, does not affect millennials to the same way that it affects boomers, right? And I would also argue, and again, this is very controversial, I probably shouldn't be saying this, is the baby boomer generation is at its core an inherently narcissistic generation, because they were born in the advent of mass prosperity, right? And generally, they were a generation that knew prosperity and safety unlike any generation in history. And they had an entire industry of pop music, toys, culture, everything was built around to service and sell to their every need, right? If you look at history in the past, youth were ignored because they died. They were sick. But you know what I mean? Like, you'd have 10 kids and six would make it to adulthood if you were lucky. The baby boomers, you had four kids and you had an entire teenage demographic. So I think it created a generational narcissism for the baby boomers. And as a result, the after effect of narcissism is this intense fear of death, right? The baby boomers were the first generation to get really into things like plastic surgery and Botox and everything like that. They can't age. They can't even let go of power. Look at our presidential candidates. Donald Trump is 73, 74. Joe Biden's 78. Bernie Sanders is 78, 79. Nancy Pelosi is 80. I was talking with my parents the other day. My mom was like, oh yeah, Nancy Pelosi's 80. I'm like, no, she's not. She's in her 70s. No, she's 80. Okay. Jared Nadler is in his 80s or 70s. Chuck Schumer, right? The baby boomers are clinging to power and they're clinging to life because of this narcissism that, you know, they're never going to die and they're going to be forever young and all that. And I think their final FU to the millennials is, we're going to destroy the entire economy and cause a Great Depression because we're scared. So that was very controversial. We might have to delete this entire podcast, but there you go.
I don't even know how to respond to that. You ended it with a bang like that.
I seriously think so. I think that the boomers are a narcissistic generation. They're never told no. They cling to power and they're clinging to life, and they just don't know when to say, hey, you know, let's step aside. Anyways, next topic. There you go. Those are my thoughts there.
Well, I was reading a comment. I was just encouraging, if we do have any baby boomers or boomers listening in, by all means.
Let me be very clear. The boomers I've known personally, by and large, are okay, right? I don't have a problem with them. But it's the generation as a whole and what the generation as a whole has done. So if you're a boomer and you're listening to this, I don't hate you. I love you. My parents are boomers. I love them deeply. But I think that generation has certain key defects which are manifesting themselves now. And one of those defects is a fear of adversity because they haven't really known it. And also a fear of any sort of death or pain or suffering or anything like that. But spicy take, sorry.
No, and so Don Rudolph chimed in how he says he made a great point, and that how we are, again, guaranteed to have the oldest president ever. Unless something unforeseen happens. So I guess maybe we'll pick up with that point right there before we talk Tim Ryan, and maybe we could talk about the Joe Biden.
Biden's perfect segue. He's a huge boomer.
Yeah. So I guess my thought here is, do you think, because boomers by and large are the voting block, the most reliable voting block, and that there's boomers obviously on both sides of the political spectrum, do you think that they're partially the reason why we have two mid 70-year-old candidates on both tickets that we have to choose from, when in theory there could have easily been, especially on the Democratic side, there's definitely a number of people probably between the ages of 50 and 65 that could have been halfway decent
candidate. You know, I mean, it's interesting, right? Donald Trump has been examined to death, right? And it's kind of stale to go over Trump, but Trump has his oddities, his eccentricities, right? I don't know of his mental state. I think Trump's mental state has declined a little bit. He clearly seems tired with these press conferences, but we're going to put him aside because he's odd even before he aged. Joe Biden, you should watch speeches of Joe Biden from like 1988, 2008, 2012 to today. The guy is clearly suffering from cognitive decline. The guy Listen, guys, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills here. The Democratic nominee for president has dementia. Okay, let me just say this again. I'm not a doctor, so this isn't an official diagnosis. Oh, you're just an economist. What do you know? Okay, Joe Biden has a form of dementia or cognitive decline or whatever you want to call it. Oh, he has a stutter. That's very insensitive. No, it's not a stutter. A stutter is you can't pronounce things and you kind of gaff and maybe you use the wrong word. Joe Biden, there's tons of clips where he forgets things. He has to look at his notepad and stuff. And he's running to be president of the United States. I mean, like, guys, and it's not like Donald Trump. Donald Trump's like here, right? But Joe Biden's all the way down here. And I feel like I'm taking crazy pills that everybody's like, yeah, Donald Trump can't be president anymore. I just can't stand the guy. Okay, what's the alternative? Joe Biden? Joe Biden? Joe Biden doesn't even know where he is. He's going to forget the nuclear codes. The Chinese are going to blow up San Francisco, right? And it's going to be like, President Biden, we have to respond. San Francisco just got nuked. You know, enter the 6-digit code. And he's like, oh, crap. You know, back in my day, ice cream was only a nickel. You know, and it's like, come on, Biden, we have to fire now. The window's closing. We have to fire the nukes. We don't have much time. Well, you know, back in Corn Pop in Delaware, I said to him, Governor Wolf, doesn't matter what we do here. What matters is if you're listening to the radio so the kids can learn. And then boom, the United States is destroyed. Right? Like, is anybody paying attention? You know, like, say Donald Trump gets a C- on his response to the coronavirus. At least he knows where he is. Presumably, right? Like, is this not an issue to anybody else? You don't have to be a partisan, you know? I know I'm Mr. Republican. I get that. Put that aside. Joe Biden's fucking lost it. Pardon my language. Joe Biden has freaking lost it. There you go.
Is that PG?
No. Are you taking notes? What notes are there to take on? Joe Biden is senile.
These are notes for what I want to discuss. So, yeah, we've discussed it. Listen, we might agree with Trump on policy. We've made this abundantly clear. I obviously have great issues with his personality. I've had great issues his entire presidency. I have issues from time to time with his tweets. Sometimes I don't mind his trolling. I thought the one this past week where he had the Biden clip and they had Obama in it, and he's saying how he has hairy legs and the kids like to touch his hairy legs. I mean, listen, that's going to come up because for some reason Biden liked to mention that he had hairy legs and likes having the kid sit on his lap. You knew it was going to come up. So, like, trolling like that, I don't mind. Some of his tweets I don't care for, though. And he said something yesterday where I think it was taken out of context from what I read. I didn't see it live with this whole thing with injecting disinfectants. And, you know, if you look back at it, I do think – was it a stupid thing for him to say? Yes. Did I think the media twist what he was trying to say and actually literally mean go inject Lysol in you or Clorox? Obviously, yes. I mean, if you look, he even says, do not, you know, I'm not talking about an injection. Regardless, it was a stupid thing for him to say.
Yeah.
But let's take a step back. He's virtually had a press conference, a 1.5 to 2 hour press conference almost every single day of the last month. And nobody can possibly say that the guy is not transparent as possible. He answers every single question. And guess what? Virtually everybody in that room hates him. And quite frankly, I'm sure he does not like the people asking the questions. But he literally takes every single question every single day from these people. So at some point or another, he's bound to say something stupid. And he does say something stupid every few press conferences, and it makes you scratch your head. Like, what's wrong with this guy? But put in the context of he's literally doing these press conferences 2 hours a day, almost every single day, and he's taking every question. Whereas a lot of what we've been seeing right now with Biden is, and a lot of his mental declines that we're seeing, I don't even call them gaps. I mean, just complete.
No, they're just not
completely
a gap.
Struggles. Yeah, so he's completely struggling in these interviews, and it's like his digital studio. These are essentially softball interviews. He had one with CNN. He had one with MSNBC. The one with Nicole Wallace. Cringeworthy between both of them. It was bizarre. But these are not very challenging questions and interviews that he's getting, and he's just struggling through it. And I think sooner or later, the media is going to have to cover this.
No, they won't.
Well, I get that, but I think when this subsides and the focus, and he's out there campaigning, and if he has more of these moments, it's going to become a greater issue. I already know. I mean, if you follow the Trump War Room on Twitter, they are really pinning their hopes on pinning out this guy as having lost it. And I'm sure they could probably go back 5 years when he was making sense as vice president of the United States to now where he's struggling immensely. So I think the Trump campaign is going to frame him as somebody who's losing it. And I feel at some point or another, and maybe I'm being overly optimistic here, the media is going to have to cover it, because I think there's two sides of this, and I'll make this one point. I think there's a side of the Democrats who honestly fear, who recognize that Joe Biden's lost it. There's a podcast that I mentioned last episode, Joe Rogan, who's somebody who endorsed Bernie Sanders, or he said he was going to vote for Bernie Sanders, says, I'm not voting for Joe Biden. He's lost it. He's clearly lost it. I'm probably going to vote for Trump, but I think that's what he said. And then there's another side that just completely relies wholeheartedly on these polls that think we're going to win. We're going to win in a landslide. And I just think that sooner or later, they're going to have to recognize that he does have issues with that.
People should really familiarize themselves with the name Tara Reid. And Tara Reid is a woman who alleges that Joe Biden felt her up and molested her while she was, I think, a staffer in Congress, or staffer and intern. It was in the early 90s. The allegations were a little out there. Her personality is a little out there. And, you know, this was something I was following. I'm like, I don't really put a lot of stock to this, right? Because anybody can make an allegation about somebody. It doesn't necessarily mean it's true. Contrary to the motto, believe all women, I think that, you know, you should have some reasonable standard before you just believe people, right? You should, if you're going to level an accusation against somebody, you need some proof.
Absolutely.
What's changed, though, is today there was somebody went through the archives of Larry King. And they found in 1994 or 93, when this woman alleges that it happened, that Joe Biden felt her up and touched her and molested her, that a woman, her mother, Tara Reid's mother, called into the Larry King live show in 1993 and asked Larry King, what do I do if a very powerful senator molested my daughter, right? And if you want more on this story, go to The Intercept. That's Glenn Greenwald's website. They're reporting into that. And, you know, with that one video, there's more credibility to this allegation than there was against Kavanaugh, right? Because against Kavanaugh, Ford had, you know, no verifying witnesses, or she told nobody right at the time, right? It was only much, much later that she told people. But you will not see Tara Reid's name get out there to the same degree that you know of Casey Ford. What is it Casey Ford? I'm sorry.
Blasey Ford.
Blasey Ford, yeah.
Yeah, Blasey.
Blasey Ford. You won't know her name, right? Now, I don't know if Tara Reid is correct. I don't know, right? But I think it's something that the media should definitely investigate and look into. And, you know, looking at Joe Biden and the way he handles people, he does like to get very feely with individuals. Now, granted, we're talking about he's running against Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is not exactly, you know, St. Francis.
Not at all.
No, not at all. But, you know, part of the argument against Trump, it doesn't come down to policy, right? Because I think he actually has strong policies. I'm willing to put that argument up to the mat. It's, well, I don't like him personally because he says gross things, he does dumb things, and, you know, he has this gross history, ignoring the fact that Bill Clinton most likely raped two women that we know of, Kathleen Wiley, and there's another one that I can't remember. Ted Kennedy murdered a woman, and now potentially Joe Biden molested a woman, right? So, you know, like, here's the thing. We're going to vote for who we're going to vote for because we're all partisan actors, myself included. Okay. I'm not pretending to be a saint. I know the people that I elect into power are people with, you know, a paucity of morals, right? I don't elect people because I'm trying to get confession and absolution from my sins. That's not why I elect somebody. I elect somebody because I believe they're going to put through policies that support me. Juanita Broderick, yes, Don Rudolph correctly identified the other woman. I vote for those type of people. But there's been, you know, on the Democratic side, there's been this smug outlook like, oh, we're restoring morality to the White House, right? Morality to the White House. This is the same White House that was occupied by John F. Kennedy, that was hopped up on drugs and womanizing women, and Lyndon Baines Johnson that would whip out his penis when he was in negotiations with people. Like, give me a fucking break, right? This is the same White House, right, that has done every sort of it's been behind every sort of war and coup and everything like that. So my only point about bringing up Tara Reid, and I'm sorry I've been going on, is to say enough with the smugness, enough with the faux morality, enough with the, oh, I'm so outraged and I want to restore honor and decency to the White House. That's gone. That era is over, okay? We sold out, we pimped out the Lincoln bedroom in the 90s, okay? It's done. It's done, okay? You know, there's no more decency coming back. It's completely gone. I'm sorry. End of story.
So you brought up a good point regarding this allegation. And it's this. The media went balls to the wall against Kavanaugh with those allegations against him for the Supreme Court. And let's put this in context. That was for the Supreme Court of the United States. That was a seat on the Supreme Court of the United States. This is an allegation against a presidential candidate. We had the allegations against Trump. There's no doubt in my mind that probably one of those allegations, one of them probably at some point or another was true.
Yeah.
Just knowing how Trump is, his personality, there's no doubt in my mind that one of those, if not all of them, in some way, shape, or form, were true to an extent. But this is where the media does himself a disservice. And I think in this particular instance, they could do themselves a great service of, listen, just investigate this. You went balls to the wall for a Supreme Court candidate. This is somebody running for president of the United States, where based on this Larry King tape that came out earlier today, there could be some truth to it. We don't know, but at least investigate it.
Fair.
Don't just do this when it goes when somebody on the other side is accused of something. At the very least, investigate it. Do the fair thing. If you want to earn yourself some trust in an age where the media trusts it in the complete and utter toilet, now would be a great time. I do see my cousin Mackenzie had chimed in, and she brings up an excellent point where once again, now we have two candidates going at it mid-70s where they've both been credibly accused of sexual assault, and it is kind of remarkable. And then if you go back to Bill Clinton, it's like, you know, what's it say about our country where, I mean, are we a forgiving country where we allow Clinton to do what he did, Trump to you know, elect Trump, knowing what he probably did do and possibly elect Joe Biden in 2020? What's it say about us if we're willing to elect somebody who is not a good moral person in when it comes to the women? We'll go with that.
I think it's childish to assume that the leader of an imperial power like the United States of America will have anything to do with morality, okay? This is – you take morality and throw it out the window, okay? Let me give you an example. Barack Obama turned Libya – and Barack Obama in his personal life was a decent guy. Like, I don't think people could make a good case that he – I don't think he had any affairs. I think he was a good father to his daughters. He turned Libya into open-air slave market by overthrowing Gaddafi, right? He droned and killed innocent civilians, right, with the drone campaign. He sent a massive escalation of U.S. troops into Afghanistan with no clear form of victory. We had a lot of lives lost in the post, you know, the 2009 to, I think, 2013 Obama escalation of troops. I think there was like as many lives lost in that period as into the previous period from 2001 to 2009. You know, so you look like presidents are not, we shouldn't elect presidents on the basis of these are nice guys or these are moral guys. We have to view that, are what type of policies are they going to accomplish? How likely are they going to accomplish those policies? You know, grow up, right? The United States is at the point where we're essentially an empire, right? We still have the vestiges of Republican institutions, but we have an imperial presence in the globe. And no matter who we elect, their hands are going to be covered in blood by the time they leave that office. that's it. That's the way I view it, right? Donald Trump is not a good guy. I would not want my kids to grow up to be like Donald Trump. I would not want my kids to grow up to be like Joe Biden, okay? Joe Biden is a horrible human being. Donald Trump is a horrible human being. You know, the people that have occupied this office have done horrible things and are horrible human beings. I vote for on the basis of, are they going to accomplish policy that I agree with? Yeah, there's a pretty good chance that they get my vote. There you go. It's a very cynical way to look at the world, but I don't know. Maybe I'm a really horrible human being.
No, I think those are fair points. So before we talk briefly for our last topic, Tim Ryan, I did want to talk briefly. So we're in April, a little over six months out from the 2020 election. You, in preparing for today's episode, acknowledge that you're of the belief that maybe right now that Biden could very well win. And
yeah,
and my initial thoughts are, you know, I looked at the betting odds today. Donald Trump's still a slight favorite. The odds have actually improved over the last 2 weeks because of, I think, a large part with the stock market kind of rebounding after tanking there for about a month straight. He's a slight favorite on the betting markets. But I think what's working in Biden's favor is the fact that Trump is the sole focus right now of everything. And Biden really is getting virtually no media coverage, but it kind of works out for him because if he was getting media coverage, a lot of these issues with his mind would be coming to light. And so I think right now it's actually working in Biden's favor. He's able to kind of be in the background, not really have to comment terribly too much on what's going on right now. And if anything, just criticize Trump if there's something questionable Trump does in terms of his coronavirus response. So I think it's still far too early to tell. I think once this subsides and this becomes a two-man race, and again, I'm of this belief that the memory issues for Biden are going to come out, that we'll see this race tighten up. I think right now the polls look very similar to how they were in 2016 at this stage, with a large national lead for the Democrat over Trump. But I think the difference is Trump is still showing some relative strength in those Rust Belt states that helped surge him in 2016 to victory. So I think it's a little too early yet. But, you know, I think Trump's got to be disciplined. I think the Trump people can't get overly cocky that automatically because Joe Biden's losing it, they're going to win this race. They have to paint that picture, but they also have to show their vision for the next 4 years and how we're going to get our economy moving forward. It can't necessarily be built, printing off another $2 trillion or adding another $2, $3, $4 trillion to our debt to get out of this. So those are just my initial thoughts on the 2020 race.
I think Trump screwed up big time with this immigration order. I think it was a dumb move. I think that Donald Trump's biggest weakness is that Jared Kushner is in the Oval Office, and that Jared Kushner is in essence a de facto viceroy or vice president of the country. From all accounts, Donald Trump, so to give people some context, Donald Trump announced he was going to issue an executive order to freeze immigration, right? It should be done. The fact that we have 24 million Americans out of work and we're bringing in more Americans, particularly through the H-1B program and all these other various programs, it's immoral, in my opinion. Those jobs should go to Americans first. Not that immigrants are wrong or bad or anything like that. Immigrants are fine. But a country, a nation state, a government exists to serve its citizens first and foremost, right? A father and a mother exist to serve their own children, right? That doesn't mean they hate other children. That just means that they have a paternalistic protection of their own family. Same with the government. So Donald Trump was going to issue this executive order. By all accounts, Jared Kushner watered it down. And it watered it down by not including H-1B visas, right? Imagine you're a high-skilled worker. You work for Facebook or Google or Apple or Microsoft, and you get told you cost too much, you're getting laid off, and we're bringing in a foreign worker from who knows where to take your job because he or she works far cheaper than you. Those weren't included in this order. This order was completely watered down. So here's what Donald Trump did. He alienated the general public, or not the general public, but I'd say the center left, right, by saying he's freezing immigration. But then he alienated his own base because he didn't clamp down on immigration nearly as much as he said that he was going to. And I think he is walking a dangerous path whereby he has not delivered on a lot of what he's promised for his base, particularly on immigration. Why was Donald Trump separate from Jeb Bush or Marco Rubio or any of those other stale losers? Because he was willing to take on the immigration issue. Immigration is an economic issue because it affects poor and middle-class Americans the most. It's a cultural issue because it's about what type of country we want to be. And it's an identity issue because who are we as an American people? Immigration plays into all of these. And Donald Trump was the only one to, you know, cut past the platitudes of we're a nation of immigrants, which, by the way, came from JFK, right? That wasn't uttered before him. And, you know, to ask some really deep questions, and he's not delivering. So in my mind, I think Trump is very vulnerable because college-educated white voters are not voting for him. He's made a little bit of gains with Hispanics and black voters, but not nearly enough to offset the losses from college-educated white voters or suburban whites, right? Whatever demographic category you want to call it. And I think he's looking very, very vulnerable. I don't think people want to vote for Biden. I think Biden is the dementia Joe, right? But he's the non-Trump candidate, and I think it's doing what I think Trump, if the election were held today, Trump would lose. He has no message. He has no momentum. His whole message of fighting socialism, we've dropped that, right? Like, he needs a very strong message. He needs to get back to basics and fight it, or else he's going to lose. I'm not saying this because I want it to happen. I'm just saying, like, that's where I think we are.
I mean, those are honest observations, and I can kind of see where you're coming from. And that's why I think that he needs this COVID situation to end. So, you know, I don't know if he's even going to be able to do his rallies. I mean, he loves those types of things, and that rallies his base. And there's really nothing right now that's going to rally the base. I mean, his little press conferences aren't doing the trick. And I think he needs to have a strong base going into this election to push him over the finish line if he is going to win. And I do agree with you. I think if he's vulnerable in one area, and the Republican Party needs to be very vigilant of this, it's suburbia. You've already lost urban America. You're not going to get that back. You have a growing base, I think, in the rural parts, and maybe you're reaching voters who haven't voted. That works in your favor. But suburbia at one point in time was something that worked in the favor of the Republicans, and you can't lose that moving forward, because Trump might be able to win in 2020 with it. But if you continue to alienate it enough, the Republican Party is going to have a tough means to be victorious consistently in the future. So I see where you're coming from with that, and I think it's something that he needs to pay closer attention to. And again, I mentioned it, these idea, these bubbles. You got to get out of these bubbles. Just because you have a great, you know, 20,000 people come to your rallies doesn't mean those people who live within a 5-mile radius of that place agree with you. It just means that you have a rabid amount of support from your strongest supporters. But you got to also listen to the people who don't like Biden, don't necessarily like Trump, and are uncertain of who they're going to vote for. And I think Trump needs to do it, and his campaign needs to do a much better job on that, because if they get cocky about this, they will lose in November.
Yeah, agreed. What was it? Do you want to shift to Tim Ryan now?
Yes.
Are we going to end with Tim Ryan?
There's a couple comments I wanted to highlight. So this one is from my cousin Mackenzie. So what are your thoughts on the impact of the election if in-person voting remains up in the air and relies more heavily on mail-in ballots? So my concern with that is just my personal opinion. I requested a ballot on March 30th or something like that. It took almost 2 weeks to get my ballot. Granted, I was just getting a little nervous, and you could track it on the county website. My concern is we all have probably had things in the mail that have gotten lost. You're taking that element of certainty out of it, because when you go and have a physical ballot and you put it in the machine, the number shows up that you cast your ballot. That's that reassurance for you. And I do have issues in some way with this idea of a mail-in general election. I think it's just riskier. And it's, to me, it's just something we got to avoid if possible. If, you know, if people want to vote by mail, request an absentee ballot. But for the rest of us who do want to vote in person, let us vote in person. Well, if this is still a thing come November, we'll take the proper precautions. Don't cancel the election. Don't force us to mail in our ballots for the sake of public health or what have you. If we want to, as voters, to cast our ballot in person, just let us.
I agree. I think my compromise would be making voting election day a holiday, but to force it all to be in person. What I don't like is that people are voting when you have mail-in votes with different sets of information. So say you vote on Monday, and then on Tuesday somebody drops out, or it's revealed that, you know, candidate A beats his wife or something, you know, like that, right? And then you have essentially several different mini elections based on when people submit the ballot. So I'm not a big fan of
That's an excellent point, and that is my biggest criticism of early voting, is there's still 2-3 weeks after you vote where something can happen. And think back to 2016. You had the one the allegations that come out against Trump, and then 10 days before the election or so, the Comey letter comes out that they're going to open up the investigation against Hillary. That's pertinent information that could easily sway an independent voter one way or the other. And that's why I think it's important to wait till those last few days and then to cast it in person, because so much happens. A week in politics is an eternity in politics, and so much can change. So I definitely see where you're coming from, Dane, on that. So the last topic I did want to mention was, so Tim Ryan, Congressman Tim Ryan, is proposing an additional stimulus. And I do have – I want to take issue with this. So – his package is essentially $2,000 a month. I believe it's for anybody age 16 and above. And American people in that age range would continue to receive $2,000 a month until employment returns to pre-COVID-19 levels. I just want to throw something out, and we apparently have just lost Dane. We'll try to get him back here momentarily. I want to throw something out here. Pre-COVID-19 levels, so the unemployment rate immediately prior to the – we lost you, Dane. I'm glad we got you back there. The unemployment rate in February of this year was 3.5%. And just to put it into context, the last time the United States had unemployment that low was back in 1969 or 1970. So it's been 50 years. If you pass something like this, it could be another 50 years before we get to these employment – now, I don't know if they use the term – employment levels or unemployment in his bill. But if it's unemployment, you in theory could lock this in for 50 years where we're stuck paying Americans $2,000 a month because of this stimulus package, which to me is just something that is here. Let me make sure Dane is put in place here on the stream. He is back. Sorry about that. There we go. To me, it's just, they're disguising this as a stimulus package, but if anything, I think they're trying to utilize this to advance their agenda. This is something that the left would love to get in place at any point in time, and I think they're trying to use this to make it happen. And to me, it's frustrating. I mean, we've already spent, what, $2-4 trillion on our stimuluses thus far? I mean, we don't have the money for this, Tim Ryan. How are we going to pay for this?
But don't we? Why don't we have the money?
I understand you're saying money's free right now, but you can't continue. I mean, they said, I thought that the last I read was it's going to add another 3-point-something trillion, the latest CBO estimate was. And that's just in a short – that's just this year. If you pass something like this, you're adding – you could be adding another 3-4 trillion every year for the next X number of decades. That's where I have fault with this.
I don't think it's
well. It won't. Passed. It's just the point I wanted to bring up, how ridiculous it is.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Tim has issues with sobriety, I think, as we all have known, have established, and he probably wasn't sober when he wrote this bill. are one of his minimum wage interns wrote the bill. $2,000 a month, if you give it to everybody, I mean, I don't see the problem with universal basic income is that people aren't responsible enough to spend their money, right? Like, this is the whoa, Dane, what are you saying? Like, that sounds very rude. No, but this is the reality, right? If you just, instead of, if you eliminated welfare and Medicaid and SNAP, supplemental nutritional assistance program, you eliminated all these programs and just cut people a check, right? You'd have a large portion of that population that's receiving assistance that would just spend it on lottery tickets or something stupid, right? And then they'd be starving, and then you'd be like, oh crap. The reason why the government has all these various programs sequestered based on the various focus of the program, like SNAP is only food, Medicaid is only medical care, etc., is because there's a implicit assumption there that the government's saying, we know how to spend this money better than you, right? And we want to make sure that it goes to medical care and food and child support and et cetera, et cetera. So that's the big problem with UBI. It's just, I don't think people are responsible enough to spend the money correctly and to manage the money correctly. Tim Ryan is obviously trying to get universal basic income in through the back door, right? That's what this is. It's never let a crisis go to waste, to quote Rahm Emanuel. He wants to keep the spending high, and he wants to, you know, create a dependent class on the government and expand the roles, et cetera. But I don't know. It's Tim Ryan. Like, you know, Tim Ryan says a lot of kooky things, but they don't actually happen. I feel like Tim Ryan's won this battle because the fact that we're releasing Oxygen talking about a Tim Ryan plan that's never going to come to fruition shows that he's already won that battle.
No, I acknowledge that, but I think it's good to take a step back and look at this. He paints himself as to be some moderate, but to me, there's nothing moderate about this bill. And I'll say this about universal basic income, and the only means I would ever possibly consider something like this is if you do it in a way where you completely eliminate the entire welfare state of the country.
You can't.
I understand. Yeah. That would be the only means of doing something like that. But then it gets to the point of the same issue with the stimulus. People would be getting money that have jobs and what have you and don't need it, where people who in theory should be on some sort of government aid if you're in favor of that sort of thing aren't getting, I guess, the necessary amounts they need. But that would be, I guess, the only instance. And I think that would be a fascinating debate to have some people on to discuss that at some point.
Yeah, that would actually be good. You know, actually, there were several cities in New Jersey in the 1970s. Richard Nixon proposed a form of universal basic income. And there were several cities that studied it and its effects. And I think in Canada as well, they looked at the effects of universal basic income, and it didn't turn out as well as people presumed. But I think it's an idea that it's kind of popular and it's kind of a meme. But I think there are a lot of severe problems with it, and chief among them is that you'd only have UBI if you eliminated all other welfare programs, but you can't trust people to spend the money properly on things like food and medical care, et cetera, especially people that have children, right? You can't necessarily trust them to spend that money on their children.
And that, as you mentioned that, it's sort of like one of those things where the idea of Social Security, I mean, I'm sure there's an argument that you should privatize it, but then the issue is if you have somebody who elects to privatize their Social Security, are they, again, going to do what they're supposed to do? And I'm not justifying the Social Security system, but that would be an argument against privatizing it, because it comes down to personal responsibility then, and we know we're all, we could all not, we're a country that I would think financially is not the most responsible when you look at debt levels in this country, especially like credit card debt. So I hear your point there. So any other final thoughts for our second Facebook Live and on our 11th episode here?
Well, I just want to say this. This has been a longer episode. I think there's a lot discussed. I would say to people, first of all, no matter what you feel about the current coronavirus situation, if you're coming across somebody that disagrees with you, try to think the best of them and think, assume that they're coming from with the best of motives. people that don't want to open up are genuinely afraid. The majority of those people, not all of them, but the majority, people that want to open up, they're not just greedy or dumb or ignorant. You know, they're concerned about their livelihoods or about supply chains or about, you know, what's going to happen to our economy. So I would say, I would conclude with, you know, in these trying times, really focus on the best of other people and always think the best of other people, except for Joe Biden, who is probably a rapist, and Bill Clinton, who is 100% a rapist. And don't leave your kids with them at all. And
that's a good final point. And I was listening to something today. There's the Catholic bishop. I follow his YouTube channel. I found one of his videos today when I was working. He had somebody speak, and the bishop's name is Robert Barron, but he had somebody speak. His name was Arthur Brooks.
I know both of those individuals.
Yeah, so he gave a talk on a book, I believe he wrote. It's called Love Your Enemies. I don't know where Arthur's at on the political spectrum. I know he acknowledged his parents.
He used to be the head of AEI, Arthur Brooks, the American Enterprise Institute.
And he had mentioned he was in D.C. at one point in time. But he wrote something, or his speech was on loving your enemies, and he used it in the context of politics and how polarized we are as a nation right now. And he said something that kind of hit home to me, and I thought it was something I mentioned today. It was this idea of running towards, he used the term contempt. Essentially, I think what he's arguing is running towards those uncomfortable conversations, but treating the individual with the opposing view with sincere gratitude. And I think that's really important in this day and age, especially in social media. I see so much negativity, so much back and forth where people are just going at each other's throats. And just like, take a step back here. We're allowed to have differing points of view on things. You can get fired up about politics, but is it really worth getting like that angry about? Like, there might be the occasional thing that gets me fired up politically, but you got to take a step back. It's this idea of, don't let your emotions get in the way of facts, and just treat people with respect. One of the things we've talked about for this program itself is having some people on that oppose us, opposing viewpoints, and I think that would be really important. I think we need more of that in our country. Whether you watch CNN or whether you watch Fox News, what you're seeing is people who by and large agree with you, depending on where you're at on the political spectrum. And I think it's good to kind of have that dialogue to hear the other side, because I'm as guilty of it as anybody else. I think I know everything, but I don't. And I know I don't. My wife likes...
You don't even know what EBITDA is.
Oh, no. That's pretty sad. A couple weeks ago, but yeah.
Barely.
But I just think it's important, and it was something that I'd encourage everybody to listen. It's like a 30-minute talk, this Arthur Brooks, but I thought it was a good one, and it really would be something that I think in this day and age a lot of people should kind of tune into. Again, I don't know anything about this guy other than that. It looks like, Dane, you know a little bit more about him than I do.
Oh, I know both of those. Robert Barron, isn't it the World on Fire?
Yeah, Word on Fire Institute, yeah.
Word on Fire, yes. Yeah. He's a cool dude. He reminds me of like a Father Murphy with hair, who's about 20 years younger, yeah. Right? Yeah, I think those are all very good words. You know, there's an individual out there. His name is Tommy Metzinger. He's the head of the Metzinger clan. He's a really bitter guy. He's got a lot of anger. And, you know, he likes to troll us. And then there's another Metzinger. His name is it Christopher or Matthew? Which one's the degenerate one? Not the doctor, but the other one. Chris. He's a total degenerate, right? And he's just saying filthy things in the chat. And, you know, both of those people, it's like, hey, guys, you know, I'm going to forgive you. You might be my enemy, but I'm going to forgive you. I'm going to let it go because I know God didn't make us all intelligent, right? Like me and Michael Metzinger. So I forgive you, and I'm going to let it go. So I think that's the moral message.
And I will say this on a closing point regarding my brother Tom. He is a big fan of the Texas congressman, as he put in the chat, Dan Crenshaw. He's a big Crenshaw fan.
Dan Crenshaw, wait, we were about to end this stupid episode, but I gotta keep it going because Dan Crenshaw, the guy with the eye patch, right? That guy? That guy's a
fucking loser. Oh my, you don't like him.
He sucks. Dan Crenshaw, he's the most generic Republican I've ever met. I shouldn't be saying these things. You're getting me all fired up.
I think we need to have Tom on the next episode to, my brother Chris is a big Crenshaw fan as well. And our president did tweet out his a video of Crenshaw earlier in the week as well. I noticed.
What do you want from me? What do you want?
I don't
from
follow
me? No, Dan Crenshaw is like, he's like John McCain part two. That's the next episode. I'm gonna hold off on that.
I struck a nerve with Dane here.
Yeah,
I'm gonna have to have Tommy chime in on this. So, but we'll conclude our episode. So again, we want to thank everybody for tuning in. We had a lot of great feedback again, and our last episode after the fact ended up having over 1,300 views here on Facebook. So that's awesome, amazing. So we hope you enjoyed the episode. Once it's up, as our brother says, Tommy is stunned. He is not happy with you, Dane. Anyway, so once this episode's up, we encourage you, if you enjoyed it, to please share. The podcast will probably be up sometime this week, and once I get to it, and it's available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, subscribe there, and just tell your friends. Again, we enjoy doing this. Oh boy, my brother is real fired up right now. But again, thank you all for tuning in. Thanks for all of your feedback through in the chat, and we'll come in a few weeks, hopefully another episode, and hopefully we have some better news regarding COVID. And any final thoughts from Dane?
Hey, do we have a final word from
our sponsor?
Our sponsor
today?
Our sponsor for this episode is Sweet Tarts, for when you want to eat acid as a candy, but you can't find any Sweet Tarts, the candy for you. We all know the purple Sweet Tarts suck, and the blue ones and the yellow ones are decent. But guess what? 90% of the bag are purple Sweet Tarts. So Sweet Tarts, yep, the candy for people who hate themselves and want to see their teeth fall out. Sweet Tarts. They're sponsoring today's episode. We love Sweet Tarts.
It's not Lysol. Happy Easter. Or Clorox, anything like that? I thought that would have been a little bit more relevant.
No, those jerks were too cheap. They wouldn't pay the sponsor fee needed.
Fair enough. So again, thanks everybody for tuning in. Please share, like, subscribe, all that good stuff. And thanks. Thank you, Dane, for another good episode. And we'll talk to you again next time, everybody. Take care.